So nice to see you. This seems to be all the more advanced students, or the heartfelt students, well, courageous students, right? Yeah, right. And you might have heard the other night when I was coming to talk about the 12 links, Donna called, and we finally found out there was no class because there had been a gas leak, but all of that has been fixed, so we have a nice temperature, not too hot, not too cold. Hopefully, no other interruptions. So, the talk this weekend is going to be on the subject called the Mahamudra. And to begin with, we'll do a little bit of meditation, but we'll begin that meditation with one of the breathing exercises that is considered to be one of the close preliminary practices. You could say there's some preliminaries that you do before the retreat or before meditation, like, for instance, collecting virtuous karma by making prostrations or mandala offerings, purifying negative karma by, you know, confessing and doing Vajrasattva meditation and so forth, guru yoga for inspiration. But then there, when you're in the actual meditative session, in a preliminary to the meditative session, you do some breathing exercise. It's sometimes called, because it's common not only between the sutra tradition of Mahamudra and the tantric Mahamudra, which we'll sort of differentiate in a little while. It's common to both of them. Sometimes in the tantric Mahamudra is called expelling the defiled airs, defiled winds. Have you done this before? Sometimes it's called the nine-round meditation. Oh, you have. You just called it nine-round. Yeah, sometimes it's called nine-round. So there are different ways of doing this. Basically, what we will do is we will breathe in through one nostril. Let's say, and you can do this to begin with. There are variations. Sometimes you can use a finger to hold one nostril closed. Like, you might try this along with me. So with your right hand, your index finger, with the fingers, the nail side of it, close your left nostril. Breathe in. And you can imagine that air going up what's called the right nadi, that's parallel to the central channel, down to your heart chakra, which is toward the back, just in front of the spine. So you breathe in. You hold it there, and imagine that the left channel, okay, right here, imagine the left channel has, while you're doing that, is all of the negative energy of your body in the form of black energy fills up the left nadi, and then you move your finger to the other nostril and you breathe out the left nostril. Imagine that you're breathing out all of that black energy, which is the mount of the defiled mental factors, you know, attachment and anger and so forth. By mount, I might have mentioned before, in the same way that a horse rider is mounted upon his or her horse, the wind acts as the vehicle of the mind. And so if you can control and visualize the expelling of these defiled winds, you will deprive temporarily, you okay? Deprive temporarily your system of having this tendency to generate those particular minds. Okay? So, again, so starting off with breathing in the right nostril, out the left, then breathing in the left nostril without moving the finger. In both cases, holding. Imagine while you're holding, the right side is filled with this white energy that you imagine breathing in, in each of the cases, when you breathe in, imagine breathing in the inspiration of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the form of white light and energy. The left side is condensing from your body all of the negative mounting winds of the defiled minds, along with winds that act to be cooperative conditions for illness. You breathe in here, then you move your finger down to your... put your finger to the other side and you breathe out your right nostril, all the negative energy, including the winds that act as cooperative conditions of illness and so forth. And in the third round, you breathe through both nostrils. Imagine that the air, the white energy, comes in down to your heart chakra through both side nadis. And at that heart chakra, you imagine that that white energy enters the central channel and brings in all of the defiled energy of ignorance into the central channel. So how many rounds was that?
Three
rounds, right? So then you do it again. Now, I'm just doing it fast, right? And then a final round of three. That's one way of doing the 9-round meditation. Is that how you've done it, or completely different?
Second?
We
do
it a little
different.
Okay, so they're different, and we will mention sometimes when you get adept, if you were to do this over, if you do a retreat, after some time, you don't need to close one of the nostrils with your finger because you can actually just consciously breathe in one nostril and breathe out the other. You know, so you don't have to use the fingers, and also you can do the 9-round like this also. You can breathe in and imagine when you breathe out this first time, very slowly you breathe out the gross defilements. Then you pause, and then more subtle defilements, then most subtle defilements. So there's already 3 rounds just on one breath, right? Then you breathe in this one. I don't know if you can hear me breathing here. Second. And then the same thing. So there are many, many different ways you could do it. Sometimes it's advised to bring the air to the navel chakra, especially when you're doing other kinds of tantric meditations like Tummo, psychic heat. But here in the Mahamudra, where we're dealing with the subtlemost mind, it's recommended to the heart chakra, to this heart area. Okay? How do you feel? Does anyone need a refresher? So why don't you perform one or two rounds of the 9 rounds? So that means to go through those 9, perhaps twice, and then just settle and watch your consciousness. Okay? I'm going to start myself.
and let go of your attention to the breathing. Just watch your mental consciousness. You can scan your other senses. Remind yourself it's not the eye consciousness I'm going to pay attention to. If your eyes are slightly open, that might be still quite apparent. Not my ear, nose, tongue, tactile consciousness. Like a turtle withdrawing its limbs, imagine pulling your attention into your heart chakra. Just be aware of your thoughts. Emotions, maybe you're irritated, maybe you feel blissful. Without getting involved with the thoughts, just be aware of the spaciousness of the mind that allows them to emerge and to dissolve, appear and disappear. First, you might have to withdraw your attention back away from the senses again. If you sense an idea of that spaciousness within which the thoughts are moving, try to hold on to that sense. Let go of the other thoughts by depriving them of your attention and put your attention onto that understanding of the spaciousness of the mind, its clear light nature. It doesn't have a color nor a shape or a particular location. Let go of the sense of your body consciousness, as though your body is irrefutably there, present. That's just an appearance to your mental consciousness. Let go of the sense of I, an observer, that's different than the mind. That too is appearing to your consciousness as a image, as a thought. Try to touch that bare, naked, clear light nature of your mind within which these different concepts and thoughts are arising, images are arising. You may oscillate in and out of a little bit of concentration on that, maybe getting distracted, doesn't matter. Go back to that when you can. And recognize that even this appearance of the clarity of the mind is as yet itself an image, mental image of your mind, based on some real life experimentation, experience here. So even let go of that, as though trying to sense even the more subtle actual consciousness within which this mental image of the mind is arising, the actual clear light nature of the mind. And think this is the object that we're going to be investigating this weekend seminar. This is an incredible resource that we have, understanding this mind, that we can let go of our negative states, our anger, our attachment, our jealousy, our putting ourselves down, our low self-esteem, our pride. All of these can be eliminated from this clear light nature of the mind, and we can repopulate it with positive thoughts that are beneficial to ourselves and to others. Love, compassion, wisdom, patience, perseverance. Try to make a motivation for this weekend seminar, especially tonight. I'm going to participate not simply to accumulate some intellectual knowledge, but to heal myself for others. Healing and developing go hand in hand. It's like purifying negative karma and creating virtuous karma. They take place simultaneously. When you heal yourself spiritually, you're developing positive qualities. So think, I'm going to try to develop the most sublime spiritual qualities, the bodhisattva ideal of aiming to achieve enlightenment out of compassion, unbearable compassion for all sentient beings. And for that reason, I'm going to listen to the teachings. I'm going to contemplate them, weigh them in my own mind, and try to concentrate on them, meditate on them when I have some little insight into them. And then relax your attention, relax your body. Bring your attention back to the present. So, how was that? Anyone want to share any observations or questions? How was it? Was it? Could you remember? I think some of you said you've done something similar to this before, or maybe exactly like this, the 9-round meditation. Anyone confused? Breathing in when you're supposed to be breathing out, or trying to breathe out the finger. Breathe out the nostril where the finger was, or anything like that. I remember when I first went to our monastery in Nepal, 1974, and there was Lama Zopa Rinpoche gave a very simple version, just breathe in white light, imagine filling your body. This is what we should be doing also when you breathe in the white energy of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, your gurus, in that nadi. Imagine that it pervades your body, burning up all of the negative energy. You know, both mental, the vehicles of your mind, and physical ailments. If you've got some chronic problems, even, you know, disease. So I would breathe in, hold, I felt very defiled at the time. So I didn't notice anyone quite as bad as me as amongst you. In a little bit better condition, I think. Okay, no questions? Comments? Observations? Okay. So, the course title is Mahamudra. And I think it was mentioned in, it should have been mentioned in the literature that we were going to approach what was called the Sutra Mahamudra, although that's not an official title. Was it mentioned in the Radhika? So what's the meaning there? First of all, what is Mahamudra? This is a book that I would recommend if you haven't already got it, or it's by my teacher, Lama Yeshe, whose picture is up here. You may recognize just to the left of Atisha up there, Lama Yeshe, who was the guru of Lama Sopa Rinpoche and the guru of many of the older students. So Mahamudra. Maha, we talked about before, means great. Mudra has different meanings. From the Tantra point of view, Mahamudra has a slightly different meaning than is meant in the sutra sense. You know what I mean by sutra and tantra? Anyone that doesn't know? So in the tantra sense, the Mahamudra is referring to a particular state of mind, the subtlemost mental consciousness that we're not touching right now. We're dealing with the gross conventional consciousness, gross mental consciousness, right? Beyond that, more subtle, and located at the heart chakra, is a very subtle wind which acts as the mount of the subtlemost, what's called clear light mind. This is similar in appearance, if you were to get to that place, if you were able to see that, to the clear light nature of the gross mind. But that subtlemost mind can take on a feeling of bliss, mental bliss, through various exercises involving, well, sometimes a little bit like some of the breathing exercises we're doing now, but in done in much more precise ways over a long period of time at different points in the body. So that particular mind, when it is sealed, so to speak, which is one of the meanings of mudra, the great seal, like something that certifies that you bought the property, or I mean, you know, you have to go to the notary public usually to get some kind of seal nowadays. The mind, that particular subtlemost mind, when it's sealed with great bliss and is able to investigate emptiness, that's in the Tantra sense, that's called the Mahamudra. Make sense? You're looking like not quite sure. No, is that it? We're dealing with an approach with the gross mind, not the subtlemost mind, and so Mahamudra in this case has a slightly different meaning, but pretty much the same. Still means great seal. Maha means great. Mudra, maybe you've heard sometime, mudra also means a hand gesture, you know, like, oh, you're making the mudra for offering water or something like this, or that's one meaning of mudra. Also, mudra sometimes refers to, in certain tantric practices, when male and female are embracing. And it is connected with the same kind of sense of Mahamudra in the tantric sense, that both of the beings that are embracing are referred to as mudras. One is the mudra of the other. But here, the Mahamudra in the sutra sense is referring to the state of ultimate reality, emptiness. It is that state of emptiness which you could say is indelibly sealed within
all phenomena. So from the sutra point of view, it's referring mainly to the object of emptiness, also to the subjective mind that realizes emptiness, this gross, within our gross consciousness right now. And it also refers to the methods to bring about that realization. Sometimes the action, the activity. So you have the object of emptiness, the subject of the mind that realizes it is also called Mahamudra, the practices, the actual mechanism by which you can bring about that understanding, which is essentially what we're going to be talking about, the watching the clear light nature of the mind and so forth, that is also called Mahamudra. If you look through the sutras, and if you look through the Buddha's teachings of Tantra, we saw the Kangyur, the actual proclamation of the Buddha, you won't find the word Mahamudra in the Buddha's teachings. You won't find it in the sutra or tantric teachings of the Buddha. The term seems to have arisen from the practices of the Mahasiddhas. Did we talk about that the other day? The great realized ones. Siddha, S-I-D-D-H-A, that's a pretty good rendition of the Sanskrit. How would you pronounce that? Siddha. Siddhas are individuals, beings, who have deep realizations. Those realizations are feats, and I'm not mispronouncing foots, F-E-A-T-S. Those realizations or feats are called siddhis, S-I-D-D-H-I. I'm putting the S on in English. The Sanskrit word plural wouldn't have an S on the end, of course. Siddha and siddhi. So, have you heard of the 84 Mahasiddhas? Any of you? No? No? You have.
84,000 teachings of the Buddha?
Not related to, well, who knows? Generally not related to that, but it's 84, right. Herb, have you heard of the 84 Mahasiddhas?
I've heard of them, but
that's a bit, yeah. They could be anyone's, yeah. Any name that I gave you, you say, it could be, yeah. So the Mahasiddhas, Laura, were you going to? No. I forgot your name. Is it Laura? Yeah, okay. You caught me on a lucky, I usually don't remember names very easily. Maybe starting a couple of hundred years after the Buddha, there are indications in literature of great tantric adepts in India, practitioners of Tantra. Although you don't find that they wrote books right away, they were practicing the teachings, especially of the tantric Mahamudra, to try to realize emptiness with the subtlemost mind. Around that, let's say about 400 years after the Buddha, it's said that Nargarjuna, you've heard of Nargarjuna, great, both in Sutra and Tantra, Nargarjuna is said to have given teachings on emptiness, his fundamental wisdom, Mula Prajna, famous text that was the basis for all of the further expositions about emptiness, revivifying Buddha's teachings about emptiness that Shakyamuni Buddha had given in the Sutras, you know, 400 years before that, that had laid a little bit dormant, Mahayana teachings. Nargarjuna is also counted amongst the 84 Mahasiddhas. Some of the other ones, one of them was called Saraha. Have you ever heard of Saraha? You might find it very interesting. There are biographies, translations of the biographies of these very inspiring. Saraha was a Fletcher. Do you know what that means? Yeah, someone who, arrow maker, yeah. I know a family, the Fletchers in Asheville. So many of the Mahasiddhas had professions that they would pursue in order to just make enough to get by, but their main practice was the spiritual teachings. Maybe because they were not necessarily monastics, they had some kind of profession. Other ones like Tilopa, have you heard of Tilopa? Til in Sanskrit means sesame. So he was a sesame pounder, making sesame oil. Saraha was an arrow maker. Not all of them took the names of their part-time professions. But at a certain point, their teachings became transmitted and eventually written before the time of Christ, and a group of 84 of them, sort of arbitrary, it lists sometimes include some people, some lists include someone else, but generally includes certain people like Nagarjuna, Saraha, Tilopa, and some others, Nakpopa. They had incredible ability to do, one of the famous ones was, and I'm not sure which one it was, and maybe this was Nakpopa, but we can see the stories. He was a monk first, then he gave back his vows and went off to meditate in the forest. And the king had heard that he was not there alone. He had a consort, like a lady friend. And in order to humiliate him, he brought him to town. He said, "You were supposed to be a monk, now you're doing this." And at a certain point, I know they went back and forth, you know, accusation and so forth. Finally, this Mahasiddha, he was actually practicing the Tantric Mahamudra, he embraced his wife, and they appeared as Chakrasamvara and his consort, I think. And the two children they had, which the king also had the court ridicule. "Oh yeah, you're supposed to be a great Mahasiddha or whatever, you have children." The two children became Vajra and Bel. The boy became a Vajra.
What's that?
He touched it. What's your mind? He didn't get that.
Sometimes that lady, I won't say her name, or that guy, I've got a voice, it hears its name. You're supposed to say, "Hey," you know, this person. And it picks up something and then it says, "I didn't catch that," or it even interprets something that you're saying as a question. So anyway, that's good. So he embraced, his son became a Vajra, his daughter became a Bell, he embraced his wife, and they rose up in the sky and the king went. And all of the criticism, you realize all of the criticism and the townspeople that had thrown mud and so forth, that this was not an ordinary being. This was a Mahasiddha. So this term Mahamudra arose amongst the writings of these Mahasiddhas, great Siddhas. So a Siddha is someone who has some special feat or realization. The Mahasiddhas were the ones who were in the Buddhist path, trying to achieve that realization of emptiness with the subtle, most blissful mind realizing emptiness, which would bring them to, if they could achieve that, to enlightenment even in one lifetime, that might otherwise, in the Bodhisattva path, take three countless great eons. Have you heard that before?
No.
How long is countless eon? Beyond count? Can't imagine? Actually, it's a number, countless. They only went up to a certain number and they stopped. That number was called countless. Many of you here were kind of in the research triangle, so you know mathematical notation. If I say 10 to the 59th, do you know what that means? Mm-hmm. 10 to the first would be 10, it's just 1 followed by 1 zero, 10, right? 10 to the 59th means 1 followed by 59 zeros.
Yeah.
So that they didn't have, in Sanskrit, they didn't have, at a certain time, they didn't have any number. They had names for all the numbers up to that, but there's no name for the numbers after that. Later, maybe they gave names to, I don't know why that's such a large number. But that when they talk about three countless great eons, it's referring to an actual amount. It's not like, oh man, gazillion. You know, like it's just uncountable or something like that. Now, their techniques for the Tantric Mahamudra and Nargajuna's techniques to bring about a realization of emptiness on the sutra side. Nargajuna was also a practitioner of Tantra. He wrote extensively about Tantra, especially Guhya Samaja Tantra. Nargajuna also wrote essentially all of his texts on emptiness were on Sutra Mahamudra, how to realize emptiness, the mechanism, not just the theory of that, but he wrote texts on how to realize that. That's a basis for the Sutra Mahamudra. So those teachings were transmitted over time, and especially in the transmission to Tibet, in the Kargyu tradition. You know, you've heard of the Kargyupa, Kargyu tradition? They revere the transmission from various of their teachers, especially Marpa and Naropa, passed on to Marpa. Naropa was a student of whom? Naropa was a student of Tilopa. Naropa was a famous scholar at Nalanda, the monastic university in India. Maybe around, I'm not sure exactly, maybe around 900 or the late 800s. And he, sometimes Naropa is also counted amongst the Mahasiddhas. Naropa felt a little bit proud. He knew all of the sutra teachings, maybe even tantra teachings, but he hadn't the real taste of it yet. He was an incredibly bright guy, the crown jewel of all the pundits of the time, the realized ones. And he, at one time, he was giving a talk somewhere, and afterwards he was coming down, walking around, and maybe feeling a little bit satisfied with himself, and an old lady appeared, who turns out actually was an emanation of female aspect of the Buddha, perhaps. And she asked him, "Do you understand the words that you were talking about? You know, do you know what you were talking about?" And he said, "Yes, of course." And she sort of smiled and laughed, and then she said, "But do you realize the meaning? Have you realized the meaning of those words?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, of course." And she started crying and pulling her hair and screaming and then sort of disappeared. You're not sure if she just, you know, went behind some fog or a tree or she just poof. And he thought, "Well, wait, what's happening here?" And he began to search to find out how to get this real taste. She had kind of implied he might know the words, but he didn't know the meaning. So he searched for a long time. He came to the conclusion that his guru, by hearing it from the sky, would be someone named Tilopa, who is the one who crushed sesame seeds. So he went around trying to find a great Mahasiddha in India called, because he was in India, in Naropa, trying to find Tilopa. Went around one time, searched a long, long time. One place he was in town, and he said, "Do you know the Mahasiddha Tilopa?" And they said, "Mahasiddha Tilopa? No, but there's a fishmonger down by the lake, down by the river, is called Tilopa." So he went down there and suddenly he realized this was his guru, some very simple man who was catching fish, biting off their heads, taking the rest of the carcass, throwing it into the river where it would reanimate and swim off. I said, whoa. Again. So he studied with Tilopa. This is Naropa meeting Tilopa. And Tilopa sent him onto, I can't remember, 9 or 12 great deeds, kind of like the labors of Hercules. Is it Hercules? Not Hercules. Who is it? Heracles?
Yeah.
Hercules. Kind of like in Greek mythology. And he would do, sometimes he would, to please Tilopa, he would do something like Tilopa would say, if I had a real disciple, he would jump off this cliff. Well, I'm his disciple. He'd jump off the cliff, be down on the ground, broken bones. Tilopa would come, bless him, and he would be revived. It's happened many times, different kinds of things. You know. So he received Mahamudra lineage from Tilopa. In fact, I was very fortunate last year to receive a transmission of that particular teaching that Tilopa gave Naropa on the banks of the Ganges River. It's called the Gangama. You know, in India, the Ganges is called Ganga. We anglicize it, we call it Ganges, right? Do you know the Ganges River? You've heard of it? In India, it's called the Ganga. So Gangama, with that female particle on the end, oftentimes is just talking about the thing on the Ganga. So that transmission of Mahamudra. So there were various transmissions from the Mahasiddhas to various people who eventually were brought to Tibet through the Kargyu, especially the Kargyu, some in the Nyingma tradition, some in the Sakya. When Lama Tsongkhapa arrived, he studied especially with the Kargyu tradition, received Mahamudra lineages. It was called the distant lineages. That means from Nargarjuna to Saraha, these various teachings and the writings that some of them had, or the oral transmission of those teachings. But Lama Tsongkhapa, you may know, was an emanation of the Buddha, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, we believe, is not an ordinary being. Lama Tsongkhapa also had a direct communication with the Buddha of Wisdom, Manjushri. And Manjushri gave to Lama Tsongkhapa what's called the short lineage, the direct lineage, ear-whispered lineage. Not in addition, Lama Tsongkhapa also received all these lineages from the Mahasiddhas, but also the short lineage from Manjushri on the Sutra Mahamudra. And that's basically what we're going to be talking about this weekend. Just a little overview. So, in a nutshell, what is the procedure? What is, because I said Mahamudra can refer to the object of emptiness, when we talk about Sutra Mahamudra, it can refer to the subjective mind that realizes it, but mainly is referring to the method that you're using to bring about that realization, something very special. There are two ways to go about realizing emptiness. One is that you first develop an understanding of the view of emptiness intellectually. You delineate. You may study for a long time. You maybe study the texts of Nargarjuna, like in the monasteries. You read Chandrakirti and all of these other things. You debate. You get an understanding of that. And on that, after some time, you use your understanding of emptiness then as your object of meditative practice. You try to develop single-pointed concentration with that emptiness as your object. First, you understand emptiness, you get a general image of it, and then later, And so on top of that, you develop the experiential, meditative approach to that. Joey?
Would that be something like analytical meditation?
It could be, yeah. You first, analytical meditation would be involved also in the beginning part, but when you try to develop, once you've got that, like for instance, if you've received teachings on shamatha, on calm abiding, we call shine in Tibetan, there are various objects you can take as your object of shine, maybe Buddha in front, or it's always synchronistic. It was the Buddha saying, yeah, the Buddha. You can take various things as your object. You can take, for instance, love and compassion as your object of shine. But you can actually take emptiness as your object of shine if you've understood it correctly first. Then you develop shine with that as your object, and then you develop vipassana to be able to realize it. Whereas in the Mahamudra, and well, of course, that is suitable and incredibly profound in many, many great beings. That's how they've realized emptiness. Delineating emptiness first, and on top of that, developing a meditative experience. Whereas in the Mahamudra, it's the other way around. First, we develop a meditative experience, not of emptiness yet, because we haven't understood the meaning, but we develop a strength while abiding on the clear light nature of the mind. Why? Why is that special? Why is it going to be something that we can add the understanding of emptiness onto later, you know, the view, the correct view of emptiness on? Because the clear light nature of the mind has a certain aspect as we're looking at it. When you were watching your mind, the clear light nature of the mind, you may have had a feeling of the spaciousness, the non... it's formless. It's unobstructing nature, which is similar to the aspect of emptiness. Emptiness is said to be a negative phenomena that doesn't affirm anything else. It just negates existence. If you might have had a chance to listen to the talk, was it last night on the Heart Sutra?
Yes.
Mentioned about emptiness is the experience at first is what's called space-like meditation on emptiness. If you have that view, it's not as though if you're meditating on the emptiness of visual form or form, the form of your body, it's not as though at that point the form is there qualified by something else. There's no form at all in that meditation on emptiness. One of the verses in the Heart Sutra, in emptiness there is no form and so forth. You know, there is no eye, no ear, no nose, no touch and so forth. It's what's called an absolute negation, a non-affirming negation. Doesn't affirm anything else in its place, just space-like vacuity. So the object in the Mahamudra, the Sutra Mahamudra, is the clear light nature of a mind. It shares some qualities with the meditative experience of emptiness and also the post-meditative experience of emptiness. If you were to have experience of the clear light nature of the mind, it said that when you arise from that meditative experience, you haven't realized emptiness yet. So you just have this long period of time you're concentrating on the clear light nature of your mind. No other thoughts are occurring in your mind. You arise from that, and it's said that everything else around you looks insubstantial. You know, kind of like doesn't have the same solidity that it seemed to have before, which is another feature in common with the experience post-meditation on emptiness. If you've realized emptiness, when you arise from that, You know, we say there are two stages of meditation on emptiness. So the space-like meditation on emptiness, where only that vacuity appears, and then the post-meditative experience, what's that called? Does anyone know? The mirage-like meditation, is everything seems like a mirage or a dream. So even though you're meditating on something different, here when you're meditating on the Mahamudra, the Sutra Mahamudra, we're looking at the conventional nature of the mind, not the ultimate nature of the mind. But there are certain similarities both in the meditative state and in the post-meditative state to the experience of emptiness. And, it's just peripherally, the real special feature is that by familiarizing with the mind, the conventional nature of the mind, then when you add the view, you will be realizing not the emptiness of form or trees or the Buddha or yourself, you'll be meditating on the emptiness of the mental consciousness, of the mind. And it's said that because the mind is the ultimate subject of all our experiences, by realizing the emptiness of the mind, you indirectly realize the emptiness of all of its objects. So in one fell swoop, you can make very rapid spiritual progress. Make some sense? So that's what we're going to be talking about this weekend, especially this close lineage that Lama Tsongkhapa received from Manjushri. And I point to my ear as though Manjushri was whispering in his ear. We call it, and for some time after Lama Tsongkhapa passed it on originally only to a select number of disciples, maybe one at a time or a small group. That's why it's sometimes called the whispered lineage, or the ear whispered lineage, or the ear lineage. You might think it's like there's a rosary of ears or something. Not like that. The ear lineage. Ear whispered lineage. Lama Tsongkhapa passed this very special lineage, which became called the Gelupa. This word Kagyu, like we say the Kagyu tradition, it can mean, you know, sometimes the title of the text that is the Tibetan text is the basis for this, is Geluk Kagyu Mahamudra. And you might think, oh, it's a combination of the Kagyu and the what Lama Tsongkhapa received from Manjushri, this close lineage. But there's also a tradition that says that's actually referring to the Ka means speech, Gyu. It's almost like the ear-whispered lineage of the Gelupa. Okay, so that's the text. The text itself was composed, and it's interesting, it was composed by an individual called the Panchen Lama. Have you heard of the Panchen Lama? Yep. So he also wrote a commentary. He wrote a very brief text that is the basis for commentaries. In fact, we're going to read that as for part of the course. It's at the end of this book. It's Highway of the Conquerors, a Mahamudra root text of the precious Genden oral tradition. Genden is another name for Gelupa. Gewa means virtue. Denpa means having, the virtuous tradition. When Lama Tsongkhapa was first assembling disciples, his tradition had various names. One time it was called the Genden tradition, the virtuous tradition. Sometimes later they wore yellow hats. The British pundits that came, they called it the yellow hat tradition. Have you ever heard that? It's not a Tibetan name at all, so it's just like Western kind of idea. Later they were called the Gandempa, for the name of the monastery that Lama Tsongkhapa created, called Ganden. I don't know if any of you have been to... Anyone been to Tibet here? No. There's one of the three main monasteries near Lhasa is called Ganden. It's also the name of one of Robert Thurman's sons. His daughter is named Uma, right? Which is is a play on words, because Uma is the name of the Hindu goddess who is the consort of Bhairava, the wrathful deity. But Uma also is the name for the middle way, Majjhamaka. And it's also the name of the central channel, the middle channel that goes from your brow chakra to your crown. So when he named his, I think that was his first child. I think Uma was his first child. You know who I'm talking about, the movie actor. So he's kind of a play on words. He's satisfied the Hindus and the Buddhists and the Majjhamakas and the Tantrikas and everything. One of his sons is called Gandhan. But later it became the Gay Lukpa, so the virtuous tradition. So here it's at this time it was called the precious Genden oral tradition by the first Panchen Lama, Losang Chukyi Gyaltsen. So a little bit curious, because if you look at the commentary that this Lama wrote to his very condensed text, it's understandable, but it's kind of a little bit cryptic. He wrote an auto-commentary to it. You can write a commentary to the teachings of someone else. If you write a commentary to your own composition, it's called an auto-commentary. Right? Make sense? So that commentary, in the colophon of that, it says, composed by the fourth Panchen Lama. So this one says the first Panchen Lama, but it also has the name Losang Chukyi Gyaltsen. So do you know what that's about? I might have mentioned this the other day. Do you know the story how the Dalai Lama, the first Dalai Lama, was he called Dalai Lama when he was alive? No. How about the second?
No.
Third?
No, third.
Third. Went to... You see? Yeah, but also during his life, of course, but the fourth was also called, the third was given the name Dalai Lama by Altan Khan. I'm not sure. He was in the court of a Mongolian Khan. Not C-O-N. It's an allusion to political situations in the United States now. He was, his name ended with Gyatso, the third Dalai Lama, as is part of many of the Dalai Lama's names. Not all of them have the word Gyatso in it. Do you know what the word Gyatso means in Tibetan?
Ocean.
It means ocean, large body of water, ocean. Like our present Dalai Lama is Tenzin Gyatso. He has other names too, but those are the main two, Tenzin Gyatso. So the third Dalai Lama, the Mongolians could pronounce a lot of the Tibetan words, but in their way of speaking, they couldn't say Gyatso easily. It came out, even when I visited Mongolia, 10 years ago or something, if I asked them to pronounce Gyatso, if I wrote it down, even those that could read the Tibetan text, it would come out sounding like chomps. It didn't sound like Gyatso. So instead of calling him the Gyatso Lama, the Mongolian king used the Mongolian word for ocean, Dalai. In fact, when I looked in some of the classrooms, there would be a map of Mongolia, and I had to learn a little bit of the Cyrillic, the script that they still used because of their connection with Russia. In the past, they were under the influence of Russia. I look at the map, large lake, and it was something, something Dalai. So this still used, still part of their language. So the Dalai Lama was given that name. The third Dalai Lama got the name. And then, what would we say, posthumously, the second Dalai Lama said, he's the second Dalai Lama, and the first one of that lineage was called the first Dalai Lama. So similar thing here. The author of our text was the first one that was given the name Panchen Lama. He was not even given that name by a Mongolian. He was given that because he was the abbot of Tashi Lumpo, this famous monastery in Tibet, and the lamas of that had previously been given the names Panchen, which means great pandita. Chen in Tibetan means great, tempo. Pan is short for pandita, the Sanskrit word for, we even use that word in stock market. Oh, the stock market pundits are saying the Apple's going up or this or that. You ever use that word, pundit? Yeah. So he was called, they were called the pensions. And so he was called, when he received this teaching from Lama Tsongkhapa, the ear-whispered lineage, through various lamas over a couple of hundred years. And at that point, he realized it was time that this should be not only whispered for one or two disciples at a time, but that it was the right time to expose to a wider audience. So he wrote this root text, and in that colophon he said, first pension lama. When he wrote the commentary, it was all apparently by that time people had enshrined that the previous three incarnations, as opposed to the Dalai Lama, which was the previous two, there was a third pension lama, so that was, now he was the pension lama, although he wasn't called the pension lama at the time, the second one, the first one, so now the first pension lama is someone back there, and he was called the fourth pension lama. So there's a little disparity between the root text and the commentary. They're written by the same person. At one point he was called the first pension lama, later he's called the fourth pension lama. I have not seen that anywhere in any of the commentaries I've read. It's very interesting because sometimes in the same volume it will talk about the root text by the first pension lama, Losan Chukyi Gelson, and then the commentary by the fourth pension lama, Losan Chukyi Gelson, not being confused by that. It was interesting they had the exact same name, but it was because of that interesting situation. So the first Panchen Lama, or in this case the fourth Panchen Lama, this individual Losan Chukyi Gelson, who wrote the root and the commentary that we're basing Lama Lieshi's teachings based on, both the root text and the commentary, he was said to be a reincarnation of Ensapa, Gelwa Ensapa, who was in that lineage from Lama Tsongkhapa to the first Panchen Lama, or fourth Panchen Lama, Losan Chukyi Gelson. His direct guru was called, I think, Losan Yeshe, but the previous Lama in the lineage that had come from Lama Tsongkhapa was a great Tibetan master called Gelwa. Gelwa means victor, like conqueror. And Sapa. It was maybe named after the place in Tibet that he was from. I'm not sure. He was considered to be a reincarnated Lama. And Gelwa and Sapa is said to be someone who achieved enlightenment in one lifetime through this Geluk Mahamudra, this close lineage, in his suite of rooms at Ganden Monastery. I believe it was Ganden. I'm not sure. It was Debung Sera. I think it was Ganden. Or Tashi Lumbo. I'm not sure where. Actually, I don't know which monastery it was. But he himself was a lama, and he had his own suite of rooms. He was someone who was recognized as a reincarnation. And as today, reincarnated lamas would often have accumulated from the previous times of their reincarnations housing and some money that would allow them to live in relative comfort. Is that kind of housing is called a labrang. Maybe if you visited Sarah, anyone visit Sarah here? Did you visit Osel Labrang, where Lama Osel lived? Anyway, that's labrang means the residence of a lama. Labrang. And so Gelwa Ensapa, the previous incarnation of the first of Losan Chukyi Gelson, was someone who achieved enlightenment in comfort, as opposed to Milarepa, who lived in a cave, only one little white cloth and one bowl that got broken and everything. When one of our nuns, I think she might have been here at one time, visited long, long time ago, Thupten Wangmo, Ani Thupten Wangmo. Ani Thupten Wangmo wanted to do, or Lama told her she had to do, she didn't want her to do, she told her to do a 3-year retreat. And like Ansapa, her father had written Gunsmoke. Hollywood, you know, that thing on TV?
Western,
yeah, that Western. And so if you ever look, her name was Heather, her lay name was it Heather Meston? Yeah, I can't remember her first name. If you look on I noticed in Asheville on the cheap channels that, you know, have the old Westerns, Gunsmoke is on now, and there's her father, Meston, is like the writer, you know, written by that. So she had a little bit of money, and so Lama said, you should be like Lama, you know, Gelwa and Sapa. You build your 3-year retreat house. It was right in front of Tushita. I think it's still there, you know, with 2 floors, wall, doorbell, gas stove, and, you know, there's like, then the other meditators have a little mud hut with a little mud wall around it, and their food is put in by a plate. She had microwave and everything, refrigerator, and she sent out messages to get things from Delhi and stuff like that. And so he had her commission a painting to put on the side of her house, her meditation houses. She was supposed to do for a 3-year retreat a picture of Gelwa and Sapa. So that the Tibetans who came by thinking, oh, those Injis, you know what that means? The Westerners. Injis, it's kind of like from the word England, you know, as though we're all from England. Oh, those Injis, you know, they got so much money, they don't have any renunciation. But reminding them that our great Gelwa and Sapa achieved enlightenment in comfort. So you can do it too. If you've got your, what was it, Infiniti or your Lexus or whatever, or your very nice palatial home, don't feel like you have to give that up. You can be like Gelwa and Sapa, okay? So that lineage went from Lama Tsongkhapa through various lamas to Losan Chukyi Gelson, who was the reincarnation of one of that lineage called Gelwa and Sapa, who had realized in the Mahamudra. So this particular teaching is considered to be especially blessed because of that. So I'll just read a little bit of this as we go along and comment on it. We're going to be alternating between hearing this technique, about this technique, and trying to practice it. We've already done that at the very beginning. We did our first, actually, I've led that meditation in some of the other classes too, but maybe not in as much detail. But maybe now, as I've given a little nutshell view of this technique, well, I haven't actually finished this nutshell view. So from the Sutra Mahamudra close lineage from Lama Tsongkhapa, which is not exactly the same as the Kargyu Sutra tradition, a little bit different. What one does is one, first of all, has a meditative experience of the clear light nature of the mind, which is what we're doing. And there will be more explanations of how to identify this, that we've been trying to identify this clear light nature of the mind. Once you've identified that, you use that as your object of to develop tranquil abiding, calm abiding. You know, what is that? Shamatha, or what do we say? Shine, right, in Tibetan. You may have heard different names for it, so you may resonate with different of those names. So you take that as your object of concentration. Then on the basis of developing a concentration, developing single-pointed concentration on that clear light nature of the mind. And when, like I said, when you arise from that concentration, everything looks very insubstantial and so forth. On the basis of that, the mind is very, very quiet. Thoughts are not coming. And you can investigate the sense of a personal self. The self that seems to be appearing in our mind. Right now, from the tradition where you develop the view first and then you develop the meditative experience, one of the most difficult things to do is to recognize that which is to be negated in personal selflessness. Have you heard that before? Mm-hmm. Recognizing the object of negation. So something some of you, at least some of you, are familiar with. Have you ever heard before? Okay. If It's not easy. Sometimes in meditation, you're asked to instigate that by remembering someone falsely accusing you of doing something. And when the sense of I appears, that sense of I is not the body, not even related to the body, but not totally, not the sense that it doesn't have anything to do with the body. It's not the mind. It's something that seems to be autonomous, existing there from its own side. But very difficult to sustain that because it's very, very subtle. It's said to be there all the time in our mind, in our gross mind, that sense of self, and our ignorance that, from these other courses where I said, grasps to that, assumes that it's really there, we call self-grasping. Yeah. That's the basic ignorance that keeps us within cyclic existence. But it's very difficult to identify that I because it's so subtle, you have to have a very calm mind. Here, once you've taken the clear light nature of the mind in the Sutra Mahamudra as your object of concentration, mind has become much quieter than now. And you can watch within that mind and recognize that subtle object of negation more easily. So once you've developed, you may not have to develop complete tranquil abiding first, but you have quite good concentration on the clear light nature of the mind, then you can switch over to trying to identify the object of negation of personal selflessness. Because the mind that you were taking as your object of concentration is now your laboratory. Not, you know, nothing else there, no other thoughts, no worries, no attachments. So you can recognize this and within that mind add the view. Remember the Sutra Mahamudra as opposed to the ordinary way of first delineating the view and then adding the meditative experience. The Sutra Mahamudra first have a meditative experience on the concentration of the clear light nature of the mind and then add the view. What that means, first of all, to recognize that this self that you're trying to, that you've trying to instigate, to recognize the object of negation, you apply the classic Majjhimaka reasonings to prove that it could not exist the way that it appears. But because your mind is so calm, it's said to be relatively easy at that time to have some insight into personal selflessness. To have an insight into the emptiness of the person. When you have some insight into that, then you can let go of that and apply the same reasoning to the mind itself, which you've been very familiar with for a long period of time. You've been meditating on the clear light nature of the mind, first just concentrating on it, and then using it as a laboratory to watch the self, now letting go of the self and applying the same reasoning of emptiness to the mental consciousness. And to the aim of the Mahamudra then is to have that realization of the emptiness of the mind itself, the clear light nature of the mind. This is kind of like a football coach giving like the, you know, we're going to beat them because we're going to do this, that we're going to then at the halftime we're going to do this. So you got a little view where we're starting and where we're going, okay? Kind of like in a nutshell or a watermelon maybe, as he said. It's too big to be a nutshell. That was more like a cantaloupe or something. Okay. Any questions? How are we doing? Making sense? Okay. Oh, okay. So let me start reading a little bit here. This same text is translated in other places. You can find it, the root text. I also have a translation here by old Alex Berzin from his book, the Dalai Lama's book on Mahamudra that Alex kind of edited and had translated various of the teachings. That is an excellent book. I don't have it with me, but if you wanted to augment this with a book, that would be very excellent. That's much thicker and a lot of teachings by the Dalai Lama going into a lot more detail. also another very incredibly good and valuable source is this book that I'm not sure if it's still in print. You may be able to find it used. Maybe you can find it. Echoes of Voidness by Geshe Rapton. Mm-hmm. It was translated by Stephen Batchelor, who's sort of renowned nowadays. It has three parts to it. One part is the Heart Sutra. The second part is the wisdom chapter of the Majjhima Vatara, Chandrakirti's text. And the third part is Geshe Repton's commentary on the Mahamudra, the same Gelugpa Mahamudra. Geshe Repton was Lama Yeshe's guru and Lama Tsopa's guru. Geshe Repton was the Lama who told Lama Yeshe, you should take this boy Tsopa to be your disciple. Because Lama Yeshe was still student, you know, older student at the time, much older than Lama Tsopa Rinpoche, 10 years older, and he took Lama Tsopa to be his ward, so to speak. He was a Rinpoche, Lama Tsopa was a Rinpoche, at the behest of Geshe Rapton. So there's some close relation. So this particular, the third part of this text, very, very excellent. Geshe Rapton, just fantastic. Fantastic. He was one of my teachers, and so the last third of the book is his presentation of the Mahamudra. So if you get a chance, if you want to delve into this as your life work, it would be nothing more sublime that you could do with your life than to devote the rest of your life to realizing Mahamudra. So this would be a good start, Geshe Rapton's book, and then the book that Alex translated of His Holiness's teachings. There are many books you can find, Kargyu Nyingma on Mahamudra, by Westerners, by scholars, so many, but I'm not so sure. This,
what's the exact title of the book you're holding?
This is called Mahamudra, How to Discover Our True Nature. It's in the bookstore, and if you like it on your iPad or your Galaxy or whatever, you can go to Amazon.com and in 1 minute you can download it. I think it's about the same price as the softbound edition. Okay. Yes.
What was the name of the book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama?
The Gelugpa Tradition of Mahamudra.
Yeah, she was putting it there so that it's on the tape. So what?
Yeah, I was asking what was the name of the book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
And Venerable says it is the
Gelug/Kagyu Tradition of Mahamudra by the Dalai Lama with
Alex Burson.
Alexander Burson.
So you can find that also on Amazon. And I don't know if it's a PDF.
There's no PDF of it. You can get it on Kindle Amazon Used Rate, $49 plus shipping, and you can get the Kindle for $29.95.
Oh, Kindle. That's what I meant. Not necessarily PDF. Yeah.
Repeat it one more time.
The Gelug, GELUG / Kagyu, KAGYU, Tradition of Mahamudra.
So that Gelug / Kagyu, some people take that to mean a combination of the short lineage that Lama Tsongkhapa heard, along with the long lineage that came through the Kagyu tradition of the Mahamudra. But also in the Gelugpa it said the Kagyu doesn't mean the Kagyu tradition, it's referring Kagyu, the oral tradition of the Gelugpa whispered lineage. So there's a little, you know, you can take it both ways. Okay? We okay? So, I'll start. Namo Mahamudraya. It's a homage in Sanskrit, even though it's a Tibetan text. Homage to homage? What is that? Homage or homage?
Homage.
Herb or herb?
Herb.
Okay. Herb. Homage to Mahamudra, the all-pervasive nature of everything. So the first verse is coming. That's just a homage. First verse is will be understood. I bow with respect at the feet of the incomparable guru, the Lord of Siddhas, who teaches the naked state of reality, indivisible and inexpressible sphere of the Vajra mind. You know what the word Vajra means? You know, you said it's the implement that you see in the rituals when, you know, maybe Geshe is holding in his right hand the Vajra and ringing a bell, a ganta, in the other hand. Tibetan word for Vajra is what? Adamantine is English. The Dorje, right? Like, you probably know someone named Dorje is a common name. The bell is in Tibetan is called Dilbu. Like, there's famous Gantapa Dilbupa. Different people named that. So Vajra symbolizes it symbolizes several things, like the inseparable union of great bliss mind realizing emptiness. The two sides of the Vajra, joined as one. Remember I mentioned from the Tantra point of view, Mahamudra didn't refer so much just to how to realize emptiness with the conventional mind. It had to do with developing the ability to awaken the subtlemost clear light mind and induce it to have a great bliss experience, which is called innate great bliss. And with that great bliss mind, to bring the understanding of emptiness that you've understood in the Sutra Mahamudra. First you develop Sutra Mahamudra to understand the emptiness of the mind. Then you receive tantric initiations, you practice the tantric Mahamudra to develop this subtlemost clear light mind, blissful mind, innate great bliss, and you recall the meaning of emptiness that you've previously developed through the Sutra Mahamudra. So some kind of connection. So Vajra here is referring to that union of great bliss and emptiness, the realization of emptiness, also refers to a combination of, just in general, method and wisdom. You know, the ultimate method from the sutra point of view is what? Bodhicitta. Ultimate wisdom is the wisdom of emptiness. From a tantra point of view, there's more subtle, what we call it, kinds of method, more, you know, like great bliss is also considered method, union of great bliss and wisdom of emptiness. Okay, I bow with respect at the feet of the incomparable guru, the Lord of Siddhas. You know that word Siddha now, the realized ones who teaches the naked state of reality, the indivisible and inexpressible sphere of the Vajra mind. Having condensed the essence of the ocean of sutric and tantric advice, so both from the oral tradition that Lama Tsongkhapa had, also from Manjushri, included tantric practices of Mahamudra, not just the sutra. Having condensed the essence of the ocean of sutric and tantric advice, I will write down the instructions of the Genden oral tradition of Mahamudra, of the supreme Siddha Dharma Vajra and his followers who give sound instruction. So Dharma Vajra was the name of the one of the lineage lamas in Mahamudra from Lama Tsongkhapa. I'm not sure Dharma Vajra came before Ensapa or after, but in that lineage that was the Losan Chukyi Gelson received, he's paying homage to one of the other ones besides Ensapa in this Mahamudra lineage, who is also a great Mahasiddha, revered amongst the Tibetans. Is just absolutely amazing. I think some people believe he's still alive today. Okay, I'm just checking. Could be any one of you. Could be Herb. So the text in the Tibetan tradition, they have put sort of outlines. This has three parts: the preparation, the actual practice, and the conclusion. So preparation, which is what we're going to be spending a little time on. First, earnestly go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. Do you all know what that means? it said that at the beginning of any Buddhist practice, one should, even though you are, you may be consider yourself a Buddhist and you are a Buddhist, you should revivify your state of faith in the Buddha, taking refuge, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, accumulating merit by so doing, and also to generate the motivation of bodhicitta. What's the cause of refuge? How do you know? How do you take refuge? You just say the, you have to say it in a certain way, certain words. Namo Guru Bhya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya. Is that taking refuge? You're afraid. Anyway, you're afraid because I'm. Is that taking refuge?
Just saying words.
Yeah.
Oh.
Buddhanam saranam gacchami. Dhammanam. Just saying the words is just mere words of refuge. Maybe it leaves some imprint in the mind to reach, to encounter those words again in the future life. Not so useful. What state of mind do you need to develop to say those words so it actually becomes taking of refuge? Good. Okay. Someone, you've Geshe-la. I'm going to praise Geshe-la. I'll tell him his students knew the what refuge. So we say that there are, well, even more elemental than that. It said you need to have some apprehension or fear about your situation. At the minimum, fear that you don't know where you're going to go after death. Not so much fear for this life, fear for future rebirths, that you might go to the hell realm, the animal realm, the Preta realm. And out of that apprehension, fear, at least have hope that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can help. That's the absolute minimum. Generally, we say faith. But when you talk about right now, if you just encounter Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha the first time, you just came from the evangelical church or something, and say, well, I don't have any faith in Buddha. But you might have some hope. So even that is said at the beginning. Understanding the qualities of Buddha and having faith or at least hope that by following the instructions of the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, that one can be protected. They form a refuge for you. Okay, so first go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. So this means in an actual session, right? Meditative session. So we didn't do that at the beginning. We began with a breathing meditation. But it became implicit in our meditation on the clear night nature of the mind because the teachings were from the Buddha, the Dharma, and I said that we should try to motivate for the weekend seminar and for this particular class to try to heal ourselves in an ultimate way for the benefit of others, which is kind of like the sense of bodhicitta. So first, earnestly go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. Since these are the gateway and the central pillar of the teachings, and especially the Mahayana, so the gateway and central teachings of the Buddhist teachings in general, and especially the Mahayana, meaning the bodhicitta, this should not be mere words. Right? You have to know. And refuge and, of course, bodhicitta are things that develop. It's not as though You might think you took refuge with the Karmapa in 1987, so you don't have to take refuge anymore. I tease the people in Singapore that they, because I ask them, what's on their identity card? They say, oh, it says religion, Buddhist. I said, does that make you a Buddhist? You know, as you say, I'm a Buddhist, yeah, here's my identity card. Are you from Singapore? Back there? Yeah? Where are you from? China. Are you Buddhist? Do you have it on your card? No, I'm just teasing. So we have to try to develop that first of all at the beginning, because seeing the reality of mind depends on amassing the collections. What does that mean? The collections and purifying negativity. First, recite the 100-syllable mantra at least 100,000 times. Karen? and do as many hundreds of prostrations as you can while reciting the confession of downfalls. So this is talking about some of the preliminaries. And then, actually, another preliminary. From your heart, make repeated requests to your root guru, who is indivisible from all the Buddhas, not invisible, indivisible from all the Buddhas of the three times. So it's talking about reciting the 100-syllable mantra of whom? Vajrasattva, that means here. There's sometimes some of the other long mantras, like there's a long dharani of Avalokiteshvara, sometimes called the 100-syllable mantra or 100-syllable dharani. But here it's referring to the 100-syllable mantra, the long mantra of Vajrasattva. So it's not enough to say 100,000 times, Om Vajrasattva Hum, Om Vajrasattva Hum. You have to do the long one. Okay? So it's worthwhile memorizing that now, if you haven't. Did you say you memorized that? So I was very pleased that some of you said that you've memorized that mantra, because when you do a retreat, if at that time you're just saying it for the first time, so, looking at the paper, it takes you a week or two to before your tongue gets used to saying that. So if you're used to saying that now, when you try to collect these things, it's easier. So here it just mentions three things.
It
has a tune?
No,
I didn't know that. Okay.
I
whose version are you using? Beyonce or? I'm not sure. Sometimes if you go to YouTube, you can hear like Om Mani Padme Hum and from Taiwan or China or something. But this doesn't have a tune, mantra.
Thomas Opa does it. He has a rhythm.
Well, no, that's if you in a class. But when you do it yourself, you don't do it that. You say it. Just so that you yourself can hear it. Just so you can hear it. You heard me because I'm speaking in the microphone. Sometimes if you're in a group of people, you hear some people that are near you that are chanting, they disturb you, that they're saying it too loud. You shouldn't be able to hear other people. It should be just loud enough that you hear. So here it's talking about three preliminaries. Basically, it's talking about recitation of the purification mantra of Vajrasattva, which includes the meditation visualization, Vajrasattva on your head, with or without embracing consort, depends on which tantra you're using, reciting the mantra and imagining white light and nectar coming into your body, first going down, purifying, pushing out all the negativities of body. After a certain number of mantras, maybe a whole rosary or just 21, then the nectar coming up, filling up your body, like filling a bottle in the kitchen, you know, that's got some gunk in it. You fill it up the water and then brings it out the top. And then light coming right to your heart chakra, just in your mind, like turning on a light bulb. Imagine your consciousness there. This, if you can do this, this is the best of all of them. This is the one that's most connected with the tantric meditations. Lama Yeshe used to say this is the one that you would do predominantly if you're practicing completion stage, just the one at the heart chakra, light coming there. Imagining, if you have some understanding of emptiness also, realizing the consciousness is empty. It can be all of the past imprints of numberless lives and the future direction of your mind, you can be purifying with this white energy. If you close your eyes now, maybe there's darkness. If you purify your mind with Vajrasattva, maybe you close your eyes, there's whiteness. You know? And then a combination, all three together. Down, up, and light, all at one time. So that's one of the one here, and then it says at least do as many hundreds of prostrations as you can while reciting the confession of downfalls. What's the confession of downfalls? Well, here it doesn't say general confession. Confession of downfalls, generally here is this dunshak, which means what you understand is the confession sutra of the 35 Buddhas. Actually, what is that actually called? Do you know, Rami? Where does that come from? It's actually, sometimes it's called, in the older text, it's called the Sutra of the Three Heaps. Triskanda Sutra. tri means three, skanda, like we say, or we say the sutra of the three skandhas. It comes from the one of the large Mahayana sutras. It comes from, and I can't remember which one it is, I'm sorry, you'll find out. One chapter of that is a chapter on morality, and the Buddha, or Manjushri, I think it's Manjushri, is being interrogated by Upali. Do you know who Upali is? One of the Buddha's disciples? Who is Upali? Oh, I thought you said. Anyone know who Upali was? So, remember we're talking about when the Buddha left home, when we talked about the Jataka tales, I think I mentioned Upali. He was the barber. Remember when Shakyamuni, when Siddhartha becomes Buddha, all of his relatives wanted to come, the noblemen, and they wanted to do the same thing. They went to the stupa where he had left home. They cut off their hair, took their jewelry and clothes, and gave it to the barber who had accompanied them. They thought he would take it back to the Kapilavastu, where they were from, to sort of, they have left like Siddhartha did on this great search. And Upali was very smart. He was a barber, so low caste, right? Not one of the noblemen. And he said, listen, guys, I can't do this because if I go back with your things, they'll think I killed you. Before I get to the gates, they'll kill me. So I'll act as your servant along the way. And they said, oh, okay. You know, the noblemen. And so when they came to the Buddha, they asked request for ordination. And the Buddha, knowing all of this, ordained Upali first, because in the Sangha, there is the story. Remember the story of the four harmonious friends? Some of you were at the. It depends on seniority, who is ordained first in the Sangha. So when Upali was ordained first, that meant the other noblemen had to let him sit in the high seat, the best seat. He gets served first. They had to bow to him and so forth. So it was quite fitting. So Upali, who is the foremost in moral discipline. Sorry, did you say something?
Foremost morality. You did tell us.
I told you. So he's foremost in ethics, morality. Of the Hinayana, like Shariputra, remember? Well, you weren't here, not all of you were here for the Heart Sutra thing. Shariputra is considered to be foremost amongst the Buddhist Hinayana disciples, Shravakas, in wisdom. And he's in the Heart Sutra, he's asking Avalokiteshvara, how do the Bodhisattvas, I know how the Shravakas meditate on wisdom. I'm the foremost, Buddha told me, I'm the foremost of Shravaka disciples in wisdom. How do the Bodhisattvas meditate on wisdom? That's how the Heart Sutra starts. Here in the chapter that's called the Sutra of the Three Heaps, that chapter, or that a section of that chapter, Upali's, I think, inquiring with Manjushri, how did the Bodhisattvas purify their downfalls? Manjushri says something, and then I think he asks the Buddha, and the Buddha recites this part in that chapter that's called the Sutra of the Three Heaps, which is essentially the what you call the Confession of the 35 Buddhas. Okay, so that's why it's called here Confession of Downfalls. It's one of the other names of it. And then to do this guru yoga, imagining your guru on your head while you recite his heart mantra and so forth. So those are the three things it mentions here. But other lamas mention, especially Geshe Rapten mentions here in general, one can add to that refuge, collecting refuge and bodhicitta, one, reciting Vajrasattva, making the prostrations along with the Sutra of the Three Heaps, the Sutra of the Confession of Bodhisattva Downfalls, mandala offering, and the Guru Yoga. So it's just adding, Geshe Repten added also mandala offering. Why is that? Why is one asked to do this before? Why is it recommended before you begin to do intensive meditation on the Mahamudra? These are what's called the kind of special preliminary practices.
Purifying
Observation. Yeah. So, especially in the Gelugpa tradition, it said that when Lama Tsongkhapa asked Manjushri for some hints, you know, what's the secret? What's the quickest way to make realizations? What's the trick? Manjushri said, there's three things you have to do. You have to purify negativities, you have to accumulate merit, and you have to pray to the Guru as oneness with the Buddha for blessings. Pray for blessings from the Guru. And then, of course, you can say four things. Meditate. Just doing these three, your whole life you do with preliminaries, you're not going to make any realizations. Pardon?
I'm sorry, you're going to spend the rest of your life just doing the preliminaries.
Yes. No, you can.
Can you do simultaneously?
You can do them simultaneously. And also, I remember, you know, oftentimes people to do 100,000 prostrations, they often take, has anyone done 100,000 prostrations? I did, I think, 80. How long did it take you?
A number of years.
Oh, okay, you did it, you spread it out, okay. So if you did it all at one time, if that was all you were doing, generally people would go to Bodh Gaya maybe 2 months, 2.5 months. Geshe Sambo went, Geshe Sambo told me he did. Geshe Pasang at Kopan, who was like the workhorse at Kopan. I don't know if any of you met. Did you know at Kopan, Robbie? Geshe Lama Pasang. So Lama Pasang, he was the one that went shopping, that disciplined the boys. Lama Lundup was the head teacher, you know. Lama Pasang was, one time I mentioned to Lama Yeshe that, I had, because I was in charge of buying groceries for the Sangha, the Western Sangha, and I was mentioning how Lama Pasang was in town and he was giving me these orders, and Lama looked at me and said, Lama Pasang is Guru's body, is Buddha's body. And I realized, maybe, you know, just take this aspect of, he beat the boys, you know, he built the houses and he did the shopping, but he was maybe emanation of the Buddha. But, so, at one time, Lama Pasang asked Lama Yeshe, could he take time off to do 100,000 prostrations? And Lama said, no. And then said, Lama Pasang begged, and Lama Yeshe said, you have 1 week. Oh no, 2 weeks, 2 weeks. So he did 100,000 prostrations in 2 weeks, like continually, like he might sleep for 3 hours and then he was up again. So it's possible. So don't fret, you know, just tell your kids they're not going to see mom. Yeah. Right. Okay. So Lama Tsongkhapa's, Manjushri's advice to Lama Tsongkhapa, to make realizations, you have to eliminate the adverse conditions, which means the negative karmic instincts in your mind that predispose you to negative thoughts, to interruptions in your practice. Maybe you get sick, you get angry easily, or you get sued, or you don't have the fortune to find a place to do retreat, you don't have funds to do retreat. You have to purify that negative karma. Then, just like in growing a field, if you wanted to plant a field, you eliminate the rocks, the stumps, you level the field, and then you have to add some fertilizer to the field, right, before you plant the crops. Generally, you have to make, especially if the field is barren, which our minds are very much barren. Here, barren in the sense of virtue. Your minds are probably less barren than mine is, just from instincts from past lives. But say, so one has to either add to the virtue already in your mind. Are we okay, Ben? Show you? Is it telling you to stand up?
No.
Okay. Mine just told me to stand up. I thought yours did too. 10 minutes before the hour, it shakes. So we have to accumulate merit, purify negativity, accumulate merit, which becomes a substantial cause of the realizations, and then, like the moisture, to receive the blessings of the Guru, the Buddha, through his emanation in the world, the Guru. You can receive powerful blessings without a physical guru, by thinking Shakyamuni is your guru, you know. You can receive, as long as you think your guru is a perfect being, you can receive powerful blessings. But they won't necessarily be quick, because it's not someone who's you have an intimate relationship with. If you can find an actual teacher in the world with you, correcting you, don't eat that way, wash your hands, now learn the alphabet, this is the way to meditate on emptiness, giving you all, you know, maybe, you know, the boys or girls at the monasteries and other areas, they might have had teachers that taught them from a very young age. So the guru is someone who's in the world right now teaching us. If you can see them as the Buddha, which requires some understanding, it's not an easy thing to do. Sometimes people with a lot of faith don't find it difficult, but it's very profound practice, what we call guru, it's called the profound guru yoga, you know, practice of guru devotion. If you can see your present teacher as the Buddha, you not only receive powerful blessings, but rapid blessings in one lifetime. So that's why we do here, to receive the blessings, we're not just thinking Shakyamuni on your head and reciting Shakyamuni's mantra and nectar coming. You receive strong blessings that way. But if you visualize your guru, who you've come to understand as inseparable from the Buddha, from the omniscient mind, and you call upon him or her by reciting their name in Sanskrit, like my teacher's name, Lama Yeshe, was Muni Gyana. Muni is short for Tupten. Tup means, actually it's Muni Shasana Gyana. Muni Shasana means Tupten in Tibetan, Gyana. So we say, Om Aguru Vajradhara Muni Shasana Gyana Siddhi Hung. That would be Lama Yeshe's name mantra. So Geshe Gelux, you have to see what his name is. What's his Geshe Liz's first name? Do you know?
Gelak
Truduk. So you'd have to find out the Sanskrit of Gelak, Gelik, and Truduk. Truduk is Dharmakirti, right? Did you know that? Chu is Dharma. Dak means renowned or Kirti. So it's a famous name of a famous, very, very many famous pundits in India. So Geshe Rapten adds to that the taking of refuge, generating bodhicitta, and making mandala offerings. So it doesn't mean you have to do hand mudra or you have to have a mandala set, which is useful to focus the mind. The main thing is the mental state of mind that recognizes all that you can perceive, the whole universe, without attachment, that you could give it up, give it again and again to the Buddha. We'll talk a little bit about that a bit later, these preliminary practices. So if you were to do a retreat, say if you wanted to do a three-month retreat, you're not going to do a three-year retreat, a three-month retreat, you might spend the first week doing preliminary practices. As many, you would do prostrations till you were tired, reciting the Confession Sutra. You sit down, relax. Then you might make mandala offerings until you get bored. Is it doing the same thing over and over again? Yeah. You do first what you do. Usually you do the long liturgy, offering the mandala, the 37 heaps or whatever. Then you continue saying Sashi Poki Jukshin Metob Tram Virab Dini. You know, just a four line or some other verses, like in, you know, some of the other tantras. There are other very short versions. You say again and again after having, and then once in a while you do the long one again. So you imagine all the continents, all the possessions of the universal monarch that you have created the karma for. Do you have the karma to have a dharma chakra, you know, that comes in the sky and can take your troops to the other continents? You do. Every time you make a prostration, you create the karma to be a chakravartin king and have those possessions as many times as there are atoms underneath your body. So that's why lamas, when they make prostrations, they often make long prostrations. They cover more, you know, really completely, not just like, you know, they can completely go down. So in so doing, we create the karma to own these, all of these things, the precious elephant, the precious horse, you know, the dharma, the dharma wheel, and so the precious dharma, precious wheel, and so forth, precious queen. So you offer all of these things, the best of samsara, to the guru, so to accumulate merit. So just for auspiciousness, I'm going to just read a little bit more. We're almost at the end. So from your heart, make repeated requests to your root guru, who is indivisible from all the Buddhas of the three times. So that was very short on preparation. We'll go back to that later when we do some of the, during the weekend, we'll do some of these preliminaries. Okay? Just for auspiciousness. Actual practice, which is the main part of the root text. There are many ways to explain Mahamudra, but they fall into two categories, Sutra and Tantra Mahamudra. Tantra Mahamudra, or his name, Tantric Mahamudra, is the Mahamudra of Saraha. Remember the Fletcher? Sara means, it's a girl's name, right? Sarah? Sara? Also like Samsara. Sara is an Indian word that means arrow. So sometimes in the protection wheel in the various tantras, there's a, within the fire, there's arrows going around. There's a mantra that has the word Sara in it because you're talking about flaming arrows. Saraha, Tantric Mahamudra is the Mahamudra of Saraha, Nargajuna, Naropa, who studied with Tilopa, and Maitripa. You know our Maitripa Institute in Portland, RFMT, is named after one of the Mahasiddhas. In the clear light of great bliss, in it, in Tantric Mahamudra, the clear light of great bliss is produced from skillful means such as penetrating the vital points of the Vajra body itself. It is the quintessence of the highest yoga tantra taught in the corpus of essential works of the Mahasiddhas. So remember I said before, from the Tantric point of view, Mahamudra meant this immutable combination of great bliss, wisdom, realizing emptiness. So the way it puts it here, the clear light of great bliss is produced from skillful means such as penetrating the vital points of the Vajra body. Have you heard that expression before? Penetrating the vital points? Have you?
Probably, but not remembering it.
So if you know the vital point, like say you can try to develop bodhicitta for a long, long period of time. If you don't know what the defining characteristic of it is, the vital points, you can, you know, beat yourself and criticize yourself. You never develop bodhicitta. There is a graphic explanation of this. I'm going to go a couple minutes over. Is that okay with people? If anyone's has a babysitter waiting, it's just 9 o'clock just now. But I'm going to go, with your permission, I'll just go a couple more minutes. Is that okay? So there's a graphic example of this. So don't be too upset. A butcher, unskillful butcher, you know, people that don't know anything, they bring the cow or the buffalo and they take a big log and they beat it on the head until it's dead. And they cut up the body. Not so good. Oh no, I'm not sure. Still, the best one is going to be someone who still kills the buffalo in this example. That's why I say it's just an example. The middling butcher is one who has a knife or a sword or an axe, and they come up to the bull, and the buffalo still knows you're going to get it, you know, and the adrenaline is going through his body, and maybe he's able to hit it the first time, maybe not. The skillful butcher in ancient India was the sort of like the professional butcher, comes with a little pouch, a long needle, comes up to the buffalo, pats it on the face, puts the needle in the vital point here, right between the eyes, and goes right into its brain, and the buffalo just falls out. No trauma, no struggle. As you say, that's disgusting. But, this example, Just example. If you know the vital point, you can avoid all of the hardship in developing something. So when it's talking about penetrating the vital points of the Vajra body in the Tantric Mahamudra, that's referring to certain chakras and points within our body that by meditating on there, bringing your concentration there, remember I mentioned that the mind and its mounted wind, well, I didn't mention today, but they're inseparable. You can't have a mind without a mounted wind that is its vehicle, that moves it. Did you know that? No. They're inseparable. Even though the wind is a subtle form of matter, the consciousness is not matter. It's immaterial. They're both impermanent. They're the two of the three categories of impermanent phenomena. Matter, consciousness is a third category called non-associated compositional factors that are impermanent, but neither matter nor consciousness. So if you bring your mind to a certain place in your body, concentrate like it's your navel chakra, that will bring the wind, its mounted winds there too, and that can cause, that's what's called penetrating the vital point. If you know the right place to meditate, that's why these tantric meditations are very sensitive to, you have to very carefully over a long period of time, even through experience, try to find where that vital point is by concentrating in various points until you start to penetrate that. So this is talking about Tantric Mahamudra. It is the clear light of great bliss. In it, the clear light of great bliss is produced from the skillful means such as penetrating the vital points of the Vajra body itself. It is the quintessence of the highest yoga tantra taught in the corpus of the central works of the Mahasiddhas. Sutra Mahamudra, on the other hand, is the way to meditate on emptiness taught explicitly in the extensive, intermediate, and condensed perfection of wisdom sutras. There's one time when the Buddha taught the perfection of wisdom. One particular lecture was enshrined in three different written editions. The 100,000 verse perfection of wisdom. What's the next one? 25,000. The short one is the 8,000. The Heart Sutra and other sutras that you have, they are perfection of wisdom sutras, but they're not of this triad, this group of three. So in that great, the 100,000, the 25,000, and the 8,000 verse perfection of wisdom sutra explains how to meditate on emptiness. The supreme Arya, the superior being who'd realized emptiness, Nagarjuna, has stated that there is no path to liberation other than this, other than realizing emptiness as taught by the Buddha. Here I will give a commentary according to his intention and show how to introduce the nature of the mind, conventional clear light nature of the mind, in accordance with the statements of the lineage gurus. This is page 119 if you happen to have this book. Just finishing there. We're going to continue next time. Any thoughts? Questions? Okay. So I feel very fortunate to talk about this with people like yourselves who have practiced for a long period of time. Many of you, some of you new, but some of you practiced a long time, have faith in the teachings and are eager to hear. So I feel very fortunate. Having heard these teachings from His Holiness the Dalai Lama and other lamas, try to practice a little bit. I'll try to share with you in the next, tomorrow and Sunday. We'll try to finish the text, give a first coat, painting the wood in your mind of the Mahamudra. Don't expect that you're going to know everything, because I don't know everything, obviously. Even what I think I know is probably, some of it's wrong. But it will act perhaps as a basis for you to continue study. When other lamas teach the Mahamudra, you might be able to go a little more in depth. And the main thing is to put it into practice, because as I said, on the basis of practice, then to delineate the view. You don't have to worry about the view of emptiness right now. main thing is to try to calm the mind and get this understanding and experience of the clear light nature of the mind, which is an analog of emptiness. It's not ultimate reality. It's a conventional reality, the clear light nature of the mind. But it has certain features in common with emptiness that make that transition of meditating on emptiness seamless. Okay? So with that, let's dedicate whatever little merit or much merit that we've created this evening. Sit comfortably. See if you can recall that calm state of mind after we did the 9-round breathing. And then recall the clear light nature of the mind again. Whatever thoughts are in your mind, they're all like birds or clouds within this spaciousness of the mind. And just as we will do later within that clear light nature of the mind, investigating the self, the object to be negated and so forth, now just recognize that this evening we've created some virtuous karma which will ripen on us, our continuum within cyclic existence, if left to its own devices. We can actually direct it just like a horse. If we have the bridle of a horse, we can pull it in one direction or the other, rather than letting it ripen only in some superficial happiness within cyclic existence. We can dedicate these merits that they make strong aspiration, wish that they only ripen in ways that enhance our spiritual development, in a way that we also benefit other sentient beings. We become more kind, more loving, more compassionate, more wise, less a problem for others. And leading all the way to the uncontaminated state of enlightenment. Due to these merits, may I quickly become a Buddha for the sake of all sentient beings. Thank you very much. So we'll see you tomorrow, at least those of you who have the time to come. I think, what is it, tomorrow? 10. Oh, okay. I thought it was 9. 10 o'clock. Okay, so you have time, have a nice breakfast. Don't eat too heavy, because when you, as you know probably from your own experience, if you're doing meditation, better to be just a little less than, you know, don't fill up completely, otherwise you get more sleepy. Take care.